This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The question is what's the solution? And I believe that a withdrawal or a date for withdrawal will lead to chaos in the region. And
Senator John McCain's calling for more troops in Iraq. Former Democratic presidential candidate and South Dakota Senator George McGovern says out now.
I think most people now know that the war in Iraq was a major calamitous mistake, but they're puzzled as to how we get out of this mess. I've outlined a plan how we can do that with minimum damage to Iraq and to the United States.
Today, a discussion with Senator George McGovern, Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, and the American Enterprise Institute's Joshua Marabchuk. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military is being accused of killing at least 30 civilians in a raid on the western Iraqi town of Ramadi. The dead are believed to include women and children. Witnesses told Reuters news agency several bodies were left lying in the street. The Los Angeles Times reports at least 15 homes were destroyed. This is a resident of Ramadi.
Huge crimes happened at night. Huge crimes targeting people inside their shops. They only buy and sell things. They are neither resistance nor terrorists. They are not from all these things. These bodies, 25 bodies, committed no serious crimes and were not guilty.
Doctors say the number of dead increased because U.S. roadblocks made it difficult to reach the victims. The Pentagon has not commented on the attack. Meanwhile, Iraqi officials say nearly 40 people have been released from captivity at the offices of the Education Ministry in Baghdad. The mass kidnapping occurred Tuesday when gunmen stormed the building wearing interior commando uniforms of the ministry. Estimates of the number kidnapped have reached as high as 150. In other Iraq news, a U.S. soldier accused in the rape of an Iraqi teenage girl and the murder of her family is expected to plead guilty today. Specialist James Barker would be the first of five suspects to take public responsibility. Barker has admitted the soldiers raped the girl, Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, and then burned her body to cover up the crime. The soldiers also herded Hamza's mother, her father, and her five-year-old sister into a room and shot them dead with an AK-47 rifle. Barker will not face the death penalty as part of his plea agreement. In Israel, a Palestinian rocket fired from the Gaza Strip has killed an Israeli civilian and critically wounded another in the town of Sderot. Militants linked to both Hamas and Islamic Jihad took responsibility, calling the attack an act of revenge for Israel's killing of 18 civilians in Beit Hanun last week. The attack marks the first time a Palestinian rocket has killed an Israeli since July of 2005. In Mexico, a 7-year-old Mexican-American appeared before Parliament Tuesday as part of a public campaign to prevent his mother's deportation from the United States. The boy, Saul Arellano, is the son of Elvira Arellano. She's taken refuge inside a Chicago church since August in an attempt to defy a government deportation order. Saul Arellano spoke after his appearance before the Mexican Parliament.
Yo quiero que...
I want President Bush to stop capturing and detaining people so that my mother and other people stay together in the United States.
Mexican officials said they'll try to prevent Elvira Arellano's deportation. Saul was also accompanied by Emma Lozano of the Center Without Borders.
hundreds of thousands of new voters registered to vote, and they changed the Congress and the Senate in the last election. So we're extremely hopeful, not only for Elvira Arellano, but for the 12 million undocumented immigrants that live and work and pay taxes in the United States, that they will be able to live with dignity.
In other news from Mexico, a group of protesters gathered at Walmart's headquarters and main store in Mexico City Tuesday to rally against the retail giant's presence there. Several demonstrators wore Walmart uniforms and brandished chains to symbolize what they called employee mistreatment. This is protest organizer Jesusa Rodriguez.
I hope that Walmart, with their absolutely criminal and illegal policies, leave Mexico.
In South Africa, Parliament has approved a bill to become the first African country to legalize gay marriage. South Africa's cabinet approved the law this summer after a high court ruling against denying homosexuals the right to marriage. This is South Africa's Home Affairs Minister, Nosisiwe Mapisa-Kakula.
We do need to fight and resist all forms of discrimination and prejudice, including homophobia.
The civil union bill awaits approval by the second house of parliament. It's expected to come into effect by the end of November. In media news, the English language version of the Arabic satellite network Al Jazeera launches today. Al Jazeera International is billed as the first global English language news network based in the Middle East. The network has been shut down in many countries over its criticism of governments across the Middle East and has been bombed by the United States in both Iraq and Afghanistan. In London this week, British Bureau Chief Sue Phillips was asked to respond to accusations Al Jazeera has provided a platform for Al Qaeda.
The fact that Osama bin Laden has chosen to drop off his tapes at Al Jazeera Arabic is because that is the most watched Arabic channel in that region. And indeed, each time that a tape was dropped off, there was an editorial board that judged the newsworthiness of those tapes, and very little was ever shown of each tape, and sometimes nothing was shown of those tapes.
Al Jazeera International will be available in more than 80 million homes, but it won't be easy to watch in the United States. No major cable or satellite system has agreed to offer it to U.S. customers. On Monday, the cable giant Comcast said it had broken off talks to air Al Jazeera International. Here in the United States, Democratic Senator Harry Reid was elected new Senate Majority Leader Tuesday. In an interview with the Washington Post, Reid said one of Democrats' first priorities will be to increase the U.S. military budget by $75 billion. In other news, today marks a new chapter in the case of Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Abramoff will report to federal prison to begin serving a nearly six-year sentence on fraud charges stemming from his attempts to purchase a fleet of Florida casino ships. Abramoff is still awaiting sentencing on federal charges of bribing government officials and their staff members. And finally, this breaking news. A tsunami warning has been issued in Japan following an earthquake off its northeast coast. The earthquake is believed to have registered 8.1 on the Richter scale. Officials said they expect waves as high as 6.5 feet to hit Japan's northernmost island of Hokkaido and the main island of Honshu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The military's top commander in the Middle East, General John Abizaid, is heading to Capitol Hill today to testify about the war in Iraq. Abizaid's testimony before the Senate Committee on Armed Services comes a week after the Democrats swept to power. Leading Democrats are now calling for President Bush to soon begin withdrawing troops. On Sunday, Senator Carl Levin said a phased redeployment of forces from Iraq should begin in 4 to 6 months. Levin is said to become the chair of the Committee on Armed Services. However, President Bush has dismissed the calls. On Monday, he met with James Baker and other advisors from the Iraq Study Group. Bush has given little indication over what was said at the meeting, but he's rejected calls for setting a timetable for withdrawing troops.
General Pete Pace is leading investigations within the Pentagon as to how to reach our goal, which is success, a government which can sustain, govern, and defend itself and will serve as an ally in this war on terror. I I believe it is very important, though, for people making suggestions to recognize that the best military options depend upon the conditions on the ground.
Meanwhile, some Republicans are calling on President Bush to send more troops to Iraq. The leading proponent is Senator John McCain, who will become the ranking member on the Armed Services Committee next year. On Sunday, he spoke with Tim Russert on Meet the Press.
The question is what's the solution? And I believe that a withdrawal or a date for withdrawal will lead to chaos in the region. And most military experts think the same thing. I believe that there are a lot of things that we can do to salvage this, but they all require the presence of additional troops.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus is planning to meet to address the situation in Iraq. Addressing them on Thursday will be former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern. He was a leading opponent of the Vietnam War. McGovern has co-authored a new book entitled Out of Iraq, A Practical Plan for Withdrawal Now. And he joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
Now.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Can you lay out what it is that you feel needs to happen right now?
Well, contrary to the president's position, we think it's important to spell out the details of a plan to get us out of this uncontrollable mess in Iraq. We recommend first that we, our government advise the government of Iraq and advise the American people and the Congress that we're going to begin a withdrawal next month, December of this year, and we'll have all Americans out of Iraq by June of next year. That's about a six-month span. We're not advocating a mad dash to the border, not a stampede or what the critics call cut and run. We're advocating an orderly withdrawal, not the kind of forced withdrawal that took place in Vietnam so many years ago, where we saw the TV pictures of our last survivors there being airlifted off the roof of the embassy. We also advocate that simultaneously with the American withdrawal, the Iraqi government invite brother Muslim and Arab states to loan them, if I can use that word, law enforcement people to try to preserve some degree of order over the next couple of years. And the United States, as the major invader of Iraq, would be expected to pick up some of the cost for maintaining law and order there, but by people in the area, not by American troops.
We're also joined on Capitol Hill by Democratic Congressmember Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, member of the Out of Iraq Congressional Working Group. He's set to become the chair of the Government Reform Subcommittee on National Security, Emerging Threats, and International Relations. And on the telephone with us is Joshua Muravchuk. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called The Future of the United Nations, Understanding the Past to Chart a Way Forward. Congressmember Kucinich, Senator McGovern is coming down to brief the Out of Iraq caucus on Thursday. What are your plans in the new Democratic majority in Congress?
Well, first of all, it's good to be on the show with Senator McGovern, somebody who I've admired and worked with through the past decades. I want to say that there's one solution here, and it's not to engage in a debate with the president who's taken us down a path of disaster in Iraq, but it's for Congress to assume the full power that it has under the Constitution to cut off funds. We don't need to keep indulging in this debate about what to do, because as long as we keep temporizing, the situation gets worse in Iraq. We have to determine that the time has come to cut off funds. There's enough money in the pipeline to achieve the orderly withdrawal that Senator McGovern's talking about, but cut off funds we must. That's the ultimate power of the Congress, the power of the purse. That's how we'll end this war, and that's the only way we're going to end this war.
Senator Harry Reid, who was just elected the new Senate Majority Leader, Congressmember Kucinich, said one of the Democrats' first priorities is to increase the U.S. military budget by $75 billion. Your response?
Well, you know, we must have a total review of spending. I mean, we're seeing the amount of money that's being wasted right now by this government in Iraq, the waste, fraud, and abuse that takes place. We see the same thing throughout the Pentagon budget. We stand strong for those who serve our country. But let's face it, the system being gamed by people who are in the defense contracting industry, who create newer generations of weapons when we haven't even seen the utility of the first generation, we have to take a whole new approach. We're spending over $400 billion a year, money that's also needed for health care, for education, for job creation, for seniors. We have to take a new look at this. We need to be a strong country. But strength isn't only military. Strength is also the economic strength of the people, their chance to have good neighborhoods. We spend more money than all the countries of the world put together for the military. It's time for us to start to shift our vision about who we are as a nation. Because if we don't do that, we're borrowing money right now to wage the war in Iraq. We're borrowing money from China. We're not looking at our trade deficit. We're not looking at conditions where people are going bankrupt trying to pay their hospital bills. We need to shift our direction, and the direction has to be away from the continued militarization of the United States society.
I wanted to bring Joshua Marovchik into this conversation. What do you feel is the key approach that should be taken to Iraq right now?
Listening to Congressman Kucinich sounds like listening to a broken record from the 60s of the people who wanted America to follow Senator McGovern's advice and give up and surrender in the Cold War, and we would be in a totally different and horrible world today if anyone had listened to the policies that were advocated by Senator McGovern and are echoed today by Congressman Kucinich. These people were catastrophically wrong about the Cold War, and we managed to win the Cold War precisely because the United States did the very opposite of what Senator McGovern recommended and what Congressman Kucinich is echoing today. As for Iraq, Senator McGovern said what he wants is an orderly withdrawal. The problem isn't whether the withdrawal will be orderly. The problem is what in the world will happen after we withdraw. And the kind of withdrawal that these two gentlemen are advocating, which is to just get out orderly or not and let heaven take the hindmost, is going to lead to complete chaos and mass warfare and killing, not only in Iraq, but surrounding it. And on top of that, it's going to lead to disaster here at home. And the reason for that is that this will be taken throughout the Middle East as a monumental victory on the part of radical Islam over the West. They feel that they defeated Israel in Lebanon and Gaza. They feel that they defeated the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, even though they ignore the large role we played in that. And now they will feel they drove the great Satan out of the Middle East, and that they are on the rise and we are on the run, and it's going to make for infinitely more numbers of people joining the ranks of the terrorists and finding new ways. They'll be like sharks smelling blood in the water. New ways to attack us and to in our cities, in our airplanes, in our trains, and every way they can. And Senator and Congressman Kucinich will be going on with this silly rhetoric about how strength isn't, we need jobs and schools and things at home and forget the military and cut the military budget and there's lots of waste and all that stuff. And meanwhile, America will be besieged by extremist terrorists.
All right, let's take these points one by one. Senator George McGovern.
Well, let me say, first of all, I resent the implication of what has just been said about me not supporting American national security during during the Cold War period. I've always been for a strong defense. I was a bomber pilot in World War II. A lot of these so-called hawks who sound so belligerent vocally never have been near a battle scene. They know nothing about war from first-hand experience. What I know as a bomber pilot that flew in World War II is that war is a bloody business. As General Sherman said, it's hell. And that's true. And we want to avoid unnecessary wars that weaken the country rather than strengthening us. You know, Iraq had nothing to do with the terrorist attack of 9/11. The administration tried to leave the implication that somehow we went into Iraq to fight terrorism. There was no terrorist problem in Iraq until we put our army in the middle of the country. Now some of the highest ranking American military officers in Iraq will tell you face to face that we're turning Iraq into a breeding ground for terrorists. The whole Middle East is against the United States having an army there year after year. Even Richard Perle, one of the chief brain trusters of the war in Iraq and of this present administration, says that we probably should have left after we overturned Saddam Hussein 3 years ago, instead of occupying that country. It's the American occupation. This is not a criticism of the army, but putting an army of 145,000 men into somebody else's country and leaving them there year after year after year is bound to set off the kind of guerrilla activity we're seeing there now. So if you're interested in preserving America, in protecting our stature in the world and our influence in the world, the quicker we can get out of Iraq, the better. Dennis Kucinich was rapped by this gentleman from the Enterprise Institute. Dennis Kucinich made a lot of sense in 2004, and he makes a lot of sense now. It's hard for some Americans to admit that we made a mistake. We made a tragic mistake in going into Vietnam, which was no threat to us, and became our friends once we took our army out of their country. We made another tragic mistake in going into Iraq. I've always thought that I live in the greatest country on earth. We have to be great because we make these dreadful blunders from time to time, along with all the good things that we do, that nullify some of the constructive, positive things that the United States has done. I supported World War II all the way. That was a war that had to be fought to save Western civilization. But there's nothing in Iraq that requires the long-term occupation of that country by an American army.
We're going to go to break, and then I want to talk about plans. What are each of your positions on what should concretely happen? Senator George McGovern is our guest in studio. He's written a new book with William Polk called Out of Iraq, A Practical Plan for Withdrawal Now. We're also joined by Congressmember Kucinich in Washington, D.C., and we're joined by Joshua Moravchuk. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. His book is called The Future of the United Nations. Stay with us.
I'm
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Elvis Costello here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Congressmember Kucinich, your response to Joshua Moravcik of the American Enterprise Institute, that your plan to put money into the domestic economy as opposed to Iraq will just breed more terrorism.
I think the American people responded a week ago. They asked for a new direction. They're fed up with a war that's based on lies. They're fed up with seeing our brave men and women die in a cause that was not correctly stated by the administration. They're fed up with having America separated from the world community. They're looking for a new vision, one that includes America as a nation among nations, not a nation against nations. One that takes the real power of our ingenuity and creativity to create alternative energy, so we don't pursue oil as a matter of national security using the military to grab oil. Americans are looking for a new direction. And what's happened with the gentleman who spoke earlier is they're trapped in this old thinking of us versus them, that dichotomized thinking, which is a precursor of war. We're in the 21st century. War is not inevitable. Peace is inevitable if you have the capacity to work with people, not to grab their natural resources, not to insist that they have to have the kind of government we have, but to find a way to cooperate. Now, what we need to do in Iraq is this. First of all, we need to get out, and we need to get out through cutting off funds. Once we determine to cut off funds, the money's in the pipeline for an orderly withdrawal. Simultaneously, we have to work through the UN and all the nations in the region, particularly the Arab nations, to help form a transition phase to create some stability with the Iraqi people. But it's not going to be pretty. There's chaos now. There's civil war now. And it's going to be there after we withdraw. We have to understand there have been consequences to this illegal war that the United States exacted on the people of Iraq. And we're going to have to help reconstruct Iraq. We're going to make sure the people have to have real control over their oil. You know, our insistence on grabbing oil has led us into this war, and it's led us to the threshold of conflict with Iran. We have to get Iran and Syria in a solution to help us get out of Iraq. This is a new world. It's time that we started acting like it. It's time that we reflected new thinking.
Congressmember Kucinich, a quick question. Nancy Pelosi, the incoming House Speaker, has spoken about her support for Jack Murtha over Steny Hoyer to be her right-hand man. Congressmember Murtha spoke out early against the war and has proposed a redeployment or a stationing of an over-the-horizon strike force of U.S. troops in Kuwait or elsewhere to respond if necessary, about as many as 20,000 troops to remain in, say, Kuwait or Qatar. What is your response to that?
Well, I supported the Murtha plan, but I have to tell you that I think we're going to have to go beyond that. I think we're going to have to really go to a cutoff of funds, because until you cut off funds, the administration is free to deploy the troops anywhere they want. The administration is free to keep the troops there, as the president has stated again and again he's going to do. Let no one misunderstand what the White House has said. The White House is prepared to stay in Iraq through the end of its term, and we as Democrats have to come up with a new direction, and that new direction must be out. It has to be UN in, U.S. out. We need to work with the world community to enable an orderly transition, but we cannot determine to stay there. And the only way to definitively end this discussion about whether we stay or go is to cut off funds, and that is the direction that I'm pursuing. Anyone who needs more information, just go to my website at kucinich.us.
Joshua Moravcik, what did you take the election results to be a sign of this past week?
Well, the election results were a sign of people being discouraged and fed up with the war in Iraq. It's not going well. But the question then is what to do about it. I'm just stunned by what I hear from Congressman Kucinich. His stump speech that he's given us comes really from way out in left field.
What is your proposal, Joshua Moravcik? What do you feel has to happen now?
Wait, Ms. Moderator, you didn't interrupt the other two gentlemen when they were having their say, so there's no...
Yes, I just interrupted Congressmember Kucinich to find out what he thought of Jack Murtha.
You finished, and then you asked him another question, so you gave him another shot at the mic. You've set up this interview, so it's two against one, which is okay. That's, you know, it's your mic. You can do do that if you want to, but then you're going to have to let me, have my peace, or else there's no point in inviting me on. And, you know, we just heard some amazing things from Congressman Kucinich, really the what Gene Kirkpatrick called the blame America first line. This is really more like the hate America first. It's an absolute slander on our country to say that we went into Iraq to grab their oil. Around, this is what the radical Islamists said, but you know, anyone with eyes to see or the least bit of brain power can see that that's ridiculous. Things that we did in Iraq may have been mistaken, may have been misguided, and so on, but the idea that we went in there to grab their oil is just it's just a cockamamie slander on the United States. If we had done that, we could have grabbed their oil 2 years ago. We wouldn't be trying to bring peace and order to the whole country, and we don't. Our country imports a lot of oil. We import it. We have a very simple way of getting it. We pay for it. We buy it. That's how we get our oil. We don't go on imperial adventures in order to take other people's oil. Now, both Senator McGovern and Congressman Kucinich have talked about the other nations of the region, but they've both failed to mention this very important fact, which is that the other nations of the region were more or less unanimously opposed to our going into Iraq. They're now more or less unanimously opposed to our getting out the way these two gentlemen recommend, because they say, look, you Americans shouldn't have gone in. You've made a mess there. But if you pull out before there's some kind of tamping down of the violence, then it will be a catastrophe. Please don't do that. So if you're going to invoke what the other nations of the region feel, you've got to be, why not be honest about it and acknowledge what they're saying. Now, as for what I would do about Iraq, I think we need to do what we should have done in the first place, which is to send a lot more troops. I think we made a tragic mistake in trying to go in there light, to try to, apparently the Secretary of Defense thought we should, we didn't need as many troops as some of the generals told him we did, and it was a terrible and reckless mistake. Obviously, once you do something as serious and with as powerful potential consequences as we chose to do in invading Iraq, you have to make sure you don't fail. And you can err in the direction of sending too many troops, but you can't err in the direction of sending too few. And we made a terrible mistake in that regard. We didn't have enough forces there to provide security for the Iraqis after we had ousted Saddam's bloody tyranny.
You know, this gentleman who just spoke, Amy, is contradicting himself. He condemns me and condemns the congressman for criticizing a policy that we think is damaging the best interests of the United States. And yet, after saying that he's against blaming America first, he turns around and says that the Bush-Cheney administration made a terrible mistake in not sending in enough soldiers to begin this enterprise in Iraq, and that what we need now is more troops. So he reserves the right for himself to criticize our government, but he would deny that to people that he happens to disagree with.
Senator McGovern,
Amy,
if you could...
Amy, let me get in on this, please.
Josh Marovchuk,
let me have my turn. You let him interrupt me. Let him interrupt me. Now it's my turn.
Why don't you lay out your plan quickly? I want to ask Senator McGovern a question about history, about Vietnam. Go ahead,
Josh Marovchuk. Senator McGovern, your powers of logic are failing you. I think it's perfectly appropriate for me, you, or anyone else to criticize the policies of the U.S. government or the execution of policies, which is what I was criticizing. But it's an entirely different thing to do what Congressman Kucinich did, which is to criticize and defame the motives of the United States in going into Iraq or anything.
United States. We went into war based on lies. We went into war based on lies. Where's the defamation there? You defame the United States when you stand by a policy that says that we should stay in a war that's based on lies. You're sending the people to death based on lies. It's time to tell the truth. The American people want the truth. The American people want the truth. Tell the truth if you're capable of it.
Congressman Kucinich, you said that we went to kill Iraqis in order to
We went into Iraq for oil. Everybody in America knows that. The American people know that our invasion of Iraq was about oil. Big surprise. Surprise to you? Maybe, but not a surprise to the American people.
Congressman, Kucinich, you can yell louder than I can, but the fact is...
Not really. My ear is getting blown out here by your screaming.
I want to go to Senator McGovern for a minute, and I want to go back to Vietnam, because I want to ask the question. There are a number of people who are saying right now they want out now, but they are terrified of what will happen in Iraq if U.S. troops immediately leave. Can you talk about the time in Vietnam? You were one of the earliest people speaking out against the U.S. Attack and U.S. involvement in Vietnam. What happened? How did the U.S. pull out? What were people saying then?
Well, they were saying the same thing they're saying about Iraq. We were told all during those long years when I and others were trying to terminate our military involvement in Vietnam, an intervention that the chief architects now say was a dreadful mistake. And they said that if we pulled out, maybe it was a mistake to go in, but if we pulled out, there would be a slaughter of people in Vietnam of indescribable dimensions that Ho Chi Minh and his people would just slaughter everybody in the country that disagreed with him. We also were told that the countries next door would start toppling into communism if we left Vietnam. None of that happened. There was no great bloodbath inside Vietnam. The Vietnamese became our friends almost immediately after we took our army out of their country. They assisted us in trying to locate missing American soldiers. They were ready for diplomatic relations with us. We have no problem with Vietnam today. And as a matter of fact, none of the countries next door toppled into communism. So those were the scare tactics that were used to keep us in Vietnam for about 20 years. The president has said recently that maybe we have to stay until the year 2010. That's another 4 years, during which time we'll probably kill several thousand more American troops, and the terror now going on inside Iraq that began when we invaded the country will only get worse. No country in the long term wants a foreign army lodged in their country.
How did it ultimately end up that the troops were pulled out of Vietnam?
Well, you know, we were finally forced out. You remember the pictures of the American ambassador being airlifted off the roof of the embassy there, and Vietnamese trying to cling to the helicopters that took him out. I don't want to see that happen in Iraq. I don't want to see us just kicked out. I want to see an orderly withdrawal that would begin next month in December and be completed by June. And we can do that. And let me cite one poll that was conducted recently in Iraq. It was conducted by our newspaper USA Today, CNN, the television network, in cooperation with the Gallup polling organization, America's oldest polling, and they asked the people of Iraq, do you regard the Americans as liberators or as occupiers of your country? 81% of the people said they didn't see us any longer as liberators. They see us as occupiers of the country, and they made very clear they want us out. I read a statement by an American major in Iraq who's working on civic reform in that country. He said a few months ago that just about everybody in Iraq now wants us out. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And We ought to pay attention to the doctrine of self-determination of peoples. The Iraqis are quarreling among themselves now, but we can't settle that. We can't settle it or control it with 145,000 troops there. We can't control it after we leave. They're going to have to work through those internal difficulties themselves.
Congressmember Kucinich, you are part of the largest ideological caucus in Congress right now, the Progressive Caucus, and that might surprise some people. So, in fact, you have tremendous power. Are you in agreement amongst each other about what should happen? And what are the first plans once you take over? What is being proposed by your caucus and by the Democrats?
Well, first of all, when I led the effort against the administration's drive towards war in Iraq, we were able to get 125 Democrats to vote against the Iraq War resolution. That exceeded the number of people who are in the Progressive Caucus. So there are people not only in the Progressive Caucus, but throughout the Democratic Party who understand that we need to take a new direction. They understood then that the war was wrong. They understand now we need to take a new direction. They understand that's what the American people voted for. I believe we're going to be able to get a consensus among progressives to cut off funds. Mr. McGovern of the House of Representatives had put a resolution forward with that regard. I think support is growing in the direction of getting out of Iraq. And I think that we see a cutoff of funds. We'll use the money in the pipeline to have the kind of orderly withdrawal that Senator McGovern so wisely spoke of. People want a new direction. They know that we have to involve the world community. And they know the direction has to be out of Iraq. I mean, we're losing soldiers at an increasing clip. We're seeing the civil violence increase. The Iraqi people want us out. The American people, by and large, want us out of Iraq. We need to take a new direction. That direction is out. The Progressive Caucus, I believe, is on board in that direction. The Out of Iraq Caucus, which contains members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, is moving in that direction. But again, the bottom line is going to be the cutoff of funds, and that begins the next time a supplemental appropriation comes or the general appropriations for defense. We need to take this new direction. That's what the American people voted for.
Joshua Moravchuk of the American Enterprise Institute. This has just come out, a U.S. government, that the government conducted a series of secret war games in 1999 that anticipated an invasion of Iraq would require 400,000 troops. Even then, chaos might ensue. They were called the Desert Crossing Games. 70 military, diplomatic, and intelligence officials assumed the high troop levels would be needed to keep order, seal borders, and take care of other security needs. By your plan of sending in more troops, how many more and for how long as we wrap up this discussion? Joshua Moravchuk.
I don't know how many more or for how long, but a lot more until we can bring some order to Iraq. I must admit that I've never heard such blindness to history as I heard from Senator McGovern a minute ago when he talked about what happened in Indochina after the U.S. Disorderly withdrawal that he was in the forefront of forcing. There was a horrendous bloodbath in Indochina. Not only South Vietnam fell to communism, but so did Cambodia and Laos. And in Cambodia, there was one of the great holocausts of all time, something like 2 million people, just under one-third of the population, 2 million out of a country of 7 million, were slaughtered by the communists as soon as they took power. In Vietnam, there was not a bloodbath of those dimensions, but there was an enormous bloodbath. We don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people may have perished in the seas trying to escape. Those were called the boat people. They were very known and talked about at the time. I'm surprised that Senator McGovern has forgotten. But
I haven't forgotten what happened in Cambodia.
Prince
Sihanouk was in charge of that country, and we started bombing him, although he was trying to preserve a neutral stance on the war. As a direct result of that, this murderous killer came into power, and guess who put down the killing in Cambodia? The Vietnamese moved in and stopped that genocide. I sponsored a resolution in the Senate to get the United States to take the lead at the United Nations in ending that genocide, but that had nothing to do with our decision to pull out of Vietnam.
Joshua Moravchik, you have written about bombing Iran, that would be necessary now. So are you proposing staying in Iraq and bombing Iran?
Yes and yes. We're in a war against terrorism. We're up against some very, very fierce and dangerous enemies. Senator McGovern has never recognized an enemy of the United States since World War II. He thought the Soviet communists were our friends, and he thought
never
everyone else
that.
Against us were our friends. But we are up against a very fierce and bloody-minded enemy that hit us on 9/11 and that has support throughout that region. We got into Iraq, for better or worse, we cannot leave Iraq with a victory for the radical jihadists. And the way to prevent that from happening is to, in my opinion, is to send more troops until we can get control of the situation. I do not favor invading Iran the way we invaded Iraq or trying to occupy it, but I do not think we can safely live in a world where Iran has a nuclear weapon. The mantra of the president of Iran is that he wants to see, quote, a world without America, close quote, a world without America. People have paid more attention to the fact that Ahmadinejad has spoken over and over again about wanting to wipe Israel off the map, and that seems like a more feasible project, but he also has said he wants to wipe America off the map, and to put a nuclear or allow a nuclear weapon in the hands of men such as this is a formula for disaster. And so we've tried the path of diplomacy and offering them lots of carrots and inducements, and we're beginning to talk about piddling and meaningless economic sanctions, but the fact is it really comes down to two choices, which is either to accept the terror of living in a world where President Ahmadinejad has a nuclear bomb at his disposal, or using military strikes to destroy as much as we can of their nuclear weapons facilities.
We just have a minute to go, so I'm going to end with you, Senator McGovern. This issue, at the same time, the debate is going on about what should happen with Iraq. Seymour Hersh has been reporting in the New Yorker magazine that secret plans are already in process for attacking Iran, as Joshua Moravchik suggests. Your response?
I'd say the last thing the United States needs is another war in the Middle East. We've got our hands more than full keeping an army of 145,000 people in Iraq year after year. I don't know what the gentleman from the Institute wants to do. He says we need a lot more troops over there, maybe 300,000. We finally ended up with 550,000 in Vietnam. It still didn't work. They still wanted us out and forced our withdrawal. Let me make clear one thing. I'm not against using military force under certain conditions. That's why I supported World War II. That's why I supported the first Gulf War, when President Bush Sr. sent American forces into Kuwait to force the Iraqi army out of there, Saddam Hussein. But he wisely stopped short of doing what some people was advocating, of moving right on into into Baghdad, and as he points out in his own memoirs, if we had done that then, we'd be locked into a morass of the kind that his son now faces. And so let's not assume, as the gentleman does, that there's just a little radical band of people that want us out of Iraq. I think the American people spoke loud and clear in the Tuesday election that they want this war terminated. I'm convinced in my own mind that President Bush Sr., his Secretary of State Jim Baker, and his National Security Advisor General Scowcroft all opposed this war from the very beginning, and they were ignored by young Bush, Mr. Cheney, and Mr. Rumsfeld, and now we're reaping the consequences.
We have 10 seconds, and that is the discussion of bringing Iran and Syria into direct negotiations about Iraq.
We ought to negotiate directly with both Syria and Iran. Negotiation doesn't mean surrender. It means a civilized way of trying to work out an agreement.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Senator George McGovern. His book is Out of Iraq, A Practical Plan for Withdrawal Now, Congressmember Kucinich in Washington, D.C., and Joshua Moravchik, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His recent book, The Future of the United Nations, Understanding the Past, A Chart a Way Forward. Thank you all. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, Reconstructing Iraq, we're going to talk with Antonia Yuha. Stay with us. Lie on the Family Stone here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new battle is brewing in Congress over how the U.S. government monitors the billions of dollars it spends on the reconstruction of Iraq. The Bush administration and leading congressional Republicans are trying to close the office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. The special agency has uncovered several cases of waste and abuse and has helped indict several American officials on charges of corruption. The termination order comes in an obscure provision attached to last month's defense authorization bill. It says the Inspector General's office must close on October 1st of next year. The language was inserted by Congressmember Duncan Hunter, a California Republican who currently leads the House Armed Services Committee. Starting next week, Democrats say they'll introduce new legislation to restore the agency's authority and keep its investigations on track. Antonia Yuhas is with us now. She's author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. She joins us from studio in San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Antonia.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Amy.
So Congress passed a bill that would close the one monitor of reconstruction in Iraq.
Yes, unfortunately, but on the other side, quite fortunately, because of the Democrats taking the House and the Senate, I think the Special Inspector General has been saved. There's been a wonderful public outroar and resistance to this move by the Republicans. As you said, essentially snuck into a bill was this early termination date, just as the Special Inspector General was really ramping up his investigations, finally naming corporations, canceling contracts, as you say, actually achieving convictions for fraud, waste, and abuse, naming Halliburton, Bechtel, Parsons, the list goes on and on. I guess not surprising that the Republicans then chose to try and shut down this office. But I think the Democrats have saved it. As you say, the bill will be introduced next week. It has broad, actually bipartisan support. But it's only at this point to extend the office through potentially 2008. And just to put in really quickly, while the amount of money, the Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund, U.S. taxpayer money for reconstruction, has been obligated, that's about $34 billion. Many, many of the contracts that are on the ground being done by U.S. companies actually carry end dates in 2007, 2008, some even longer. I certainly advocate ending those contracts sooner, but in any case, the Special Inspector General has to be able to stay working on the ground until all of this money is accounted for and all of the companies are held to account.
Antonia, you've just written a piece, Bechtel Bails on Iraq. They left Iraq. Talk about the significance.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't choose the title, so I'd want to fix that. I have been part of movements of people since before the war began who have been calling for Bechtel to leave Iraq. So we're quite glad that last Tuesday they finally announced that they were leaving Iraq after receiving $2.4 billion of work, after receiving before the war began a quiet, secret request for their proposal to do their work in Iraq, and now they're finally leaving. Thank goodness. That's good. The bad news is that they're leaving with their money, and they have not remotely accomplished the work that they were given, and it was vitally critical work. Bechtel had one of the early, most broad contracts for the basic services. The one thing that actually the U.S. government was supposed to do as an occupier, rebuild basic services, water, electricity, healthcare, roads, all of this fell into Bechtel's rubric of their contract. None of this is done. None of this has been done even close to how it was contractually obligated to be done, nor morally what we should have accomplished. And yet Bechtel is leaving with their cash in hand.
What did they do, though, some of their claims? And do you think that they should be investigated, held accountable, and in what way? One of the things you write about is even the limited oversight allowing us to debunk claims by Bechtel. For example, the company reporting it rebuilt war-damaged bridges on key highways. But the Inspector General's October report to Congress finds no bridge or expressway projects have been completed in Iraq.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Special Inspector General is finally focusing on Bechtel more comprehensively. But at this moment, it's almost impossible to assess what project by project Bechtel has done on the ground. It's actually almost impossible to assess that for any company, any U.S. company, because the Special Inspector General, for all the great work that it's starting to do, of over 1,300 projects that the U.S. has begun in Iraq, only 65 have been assessed in a very close way by the Special Inspector General. Because of the failures that the Special Inspector General found last quarter, in particular on a Bechtel project for a critical maternal and child health hospital that was supposed to be built by Bechtel and wasn't built. And to get back to what they claimed and what the Special Inspector General claimed, Bechtel hasn't said anything publicly themselves. I'm basing all of my assessment on what Bechtel is saying based on a San Francisco Chronicle article where the reporter got to interview Bechtel. Bechtel hasn't come forward with what they have or haven't done. But they said that, for example, they did not complete this Basra hospital because of, quote, security concerns, where the Special Inspector General was quite clear that Bechtel was dropped from their contract because, one, they had misrepresented their progress to the U.S. government. Two, they had gone a year and a half over schedule and $90 million over budget, so they were dropped. We know that that took place. We know, as you say, that they didn't finish projects that they said they did, in fact, finish. So hopefully this new audit that the Special Inspector General has begun of Bechtel's, all of its contracts, will expose all of their failure. And we can get some sense of that by the fact that, as I said, the areas that they were contracted to work on, for example, electricity. The most recent report.
Antonia, we just have 20 seconds, but I want to ask. Congressmember Henry Waxman has said that they will be investigating the amount of money that's gone into Iraq, war profiteering. Nancy Pelosi has said the power that the Democrats will now have is called subpoena power. In 10 seconds, $2.5 billion Bechtel's had Halliburton. What do you think has to happen for the accounting to take place?
There has to be a full audit, but then the demand has to be made that they must return all of their misspent funds, period. Existing contracts have to be canceled, period. And third, the money must immediately go to Iraqi companies and Iraqi workers to end the U.S. corporate occupation of Iraq as well as the military occupation.
Antonia Yuhas, I want to thank you for being with us. Her book is The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. And that does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, and Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsili, our engineer. Special thanks to Sam Chambly. Tomorrow I'll be introducing Alice Walker at Stony Brook University, SUNY New York. Then I'll be going to Miami Book Fair. Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, where the time is exactly 12 noon. Coming up next, today's KBOO community calendar, and then that will be followed by more of Antonia Yuhas as she speaks from Austin, Texas, on alternative radio in a program called Oilgarchy. Here's the calendar.
This is the community calendar for Wednesday, November 15th. Abusive off-road vehicle use is a growing problem in Oregon's forests and is threatening our public lands. Please join the Oregon Sierra Club for a meeting to discuss the problem and envision ways in which Sierra Club can use grassroots power to fight this abuse. This meeting will be held at the Portland office Thursday, November 16th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. The address is 2950 Southeast Stark Street on the corner of Southeast Stark and 30th in Portland. Carl Forsgaard will give a presentation on successful work in Washington State to control abusive off-road vehicle use through travel management planning. Those gathered at this meeting will discuss similar possibilities in Oregon. For more information about this meeting, please call 503-238-0442, extension 300, 503-238-0442, extension 300. Register now for the Beyond Oil Conference happening Saturday, November 18th. The Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility is hosting an all-day conference that runs from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. and focuses on energy policies, oil depletion, U.S. foreign and military policy, global pollution, and climate change. The Beyond Oil Conference will be held at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228, at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Workshops include Using the Oil and War Connection to Promote Peace, Peak Oil, Renewable Energy and Efficiency, Economic Opportunities, Creating a Movement, Education and Advocacy, and Global Warming in Oregon. You'll also have a chance to speak to Oregon policymakers. For more information on the workshops, visit the web at OregonPSR.org. Yearly, the Clackamas Women's Services provides shelter and safety to 350 women and children survivors of domestic and sexual violence. In Oregon, 1 in 8 women are victims of domestic or sexual violence, and a likely 20,000 of those women and their children live in Clackamas County. During the holidays, you can help provide the Clackamas Women's Services with items such as women's clothing, children's items, kitchen supplies, household and hygiene items. Now through December 20th, the Michael Minyard Agency with American Family Insurance is proud to accept these donations for the Clackamas Women's Services. You may drop off these items at 4216 Southeast King Road, Monday through Friday, 659-2309, 503-659-2309. This has been the community calendar for Wednesday, November 15th. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
In the U.S. State Department before the war, there was a committee that met to draft a new oil law for Iraq. One member of that working group was later appointed by Paul Bremer as one of the first oil ministers of Iraq. And what he did in that position was cancel all of those pre-existing oil contracts that Saddam Hussein had signed. Okay, those are gone. They then devised a new model for Iraq's oil infrastructure, which would eliminate the nationalized oil system and implement a law that would open Iraq to private foreign corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the foreign oil companies on unprecedented terms for any oil-rich nation in the world.
That's Antonia Yuhas, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Antonia Yuhas on oilgarchy. The iconic moment of the U.S. invasion of Iraq was the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Ferdows Square in Baghdad. It was a staged event with extras supplied by the now discredited neocon favorite Ahmed Chalabi. What was really important was going on in the rest of the city, massive looting. Government offices and buildings, including hospitals, were ransacked. U.S. troops stood by and watched. The anarchy in the streets was of little concern to Washington. As Rumsfeld said, stuff happens. But there was one building the U.S. military cordoned off and protected, the Ministry of Oil. It was no surprise. The big oil companies, with close ties to the oligarchy in the White House, have long coveted access to Iraq's huge oil reserves. Antonia Yuhas is an expert on international trade and economic policy. She's visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. An award-winning writer, her work has appeared in a number of leading newspapers and journals. She's the author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. She spoke at the University of Texas at Austin on September 28, 2006.
The World Trade Organization is about to no longer be. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are secondary players, if that, on the global scene right now. And their power to constrict the lives of people around the world, of all of these institutions, is very much in the wane. In the ascendancy are people like, or countries rather, and in their place are social movements and people and communities all around the world that are not only embracing the rejection of this model, but the alternatives. And Evo Morales, just so you all know, is a guy I hung out with in Cochabamba, who's one of us, an amazing organizer, activist, lifelong organizer, who is now the president of Bolivia. That is not in any way to belittle his intelligence, his power, his commitment. It is to say, this type of change happens. It happens every day. People like us, with our passion, with our beliefs, can implement that and empower all the rest of us through that process, implement those beliefs. We're living in amazing times. I wrote this book as an organizing tool. My political career started working as a legislative assistant for Congressman John Conyers from Michigan, an amazing member of Congress to this day, who, if the Democrats take back the House, has committed to starting impeachment hearings against George Bush, a wonderful thing that we can do for the world. I can't imagine a better statement to the world that the American public doesn't support this president than daily hearings aired on every television station all around the world of us laying out the case in the United States Congress as to why he should be impeached. It would certainly look better to the world than daily impeachment hearings onto the sexual interests of our president, which is actually one of the reasons why I quit. In addition to shifting my attention to international trade, my job became reading the Star Report. And I decided that the taxpayers of Detroit were in no way paying me to read the Star Report. And that's one of the reasons why I left the Hill. The other reason was that I was working on domestic social policy for Detroit. I was working on welfare, job training, health care, social security, domestic military policy. And I kept butting heads with international trade agreements that were making it impossible to do the work that we were supposed to be doing for our constituents. A good policymaker lays out a bunch of interests. They are multinational corporate interests. They are businesses. They are workers. They are health concerns, consumer concerns, the environment, children. The list goes on and on. And you try and write policy that creates a balancing act between all of these very, very important elements of society. And what international trade agreements do is take all of this and push it off the table and say, you have to take this interest, the multinational corporate interests. And that's the only one you can consider. And that is, in fact, the reality. And that's what it was like on the Hill. So I left and went to organize a campaign, to help organize a campaign against this proposed agreement, the multilateral agreement on investment proposed at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And hopefully you've never heard of it, because we defeated it. And it was one of the first international movements of people and government officials to link up largely through the internet, and one of the first internet organizing campaigns as well, to defeat an international investment or trade agreement. And we did. And then the brilliant minds behind it decided that they should introduce it at the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting taking place in Seattle in 1999. And what that did was bring that entire movement that had successfully coordinated and created community links around the world to come together and turn its attention, as well as many, many other people's attention, to that ministerial meeting. And support in the number of 50,000 people in the streets, the developing country delegates in the suites, who were saying, you don't even have the support of your own people for this agenda. We don't have to take this anymore. And they looked home and they saw the marches of hundreds and thousands, if not millions of people, in, for example, in India, protesting at the same time against the ministerial. And they said, and we don't have the support of our people. We're not going to do this. And they didn't. And the ministerial collapsed. Again, starting in the north, the awareness of these institutions, and really igniting in the north, where there hadn't been before, a link with the south on issues of global justice, which have, I believed, helped culminate in the now near demise of this institution through the empowerment of delegates, through the empowerment of social movements. An institution, believe me, that multinational corporations would very much like to continue to see in existence. I have been working on alternatives to economic globalization or corporate globalization ever since. And let me read one quote. Okay, this is 1 year before September 11th. Every 5 years, the Central Intelligence Agency conducts a study looking 15 years into the future of what the greatest threats facing the United States 15 years hence will be, so that the CIA can best prepare for those threats. In 2000, the CIA report reached this conclusion. The rising tide of the global economy will create many economic winners, but it will not lift all boats. It will spawn conflicts at home and abroad, ensuring an even wider gap between regional winners and losers than exists today. Regions, countries, and groups feeling left behind will face deepening economic stagnation, political instability, and cultural alienation. They will foster political, ethnic, ideological, and religious extremism, along with the violence that often accompanies it. This was the CIA saying that one of the biggest threats to the world 15 years hence was the guaranteed increase in inequality created by the trend in the global economy. And that trend in the global economy was the increase in free trade, quote-unquote free trade policies. Now I want to read a statement by President Bush. This is President Bush speaking 1 year ago, just about 1 year ago, almost exactly 1 year ago today, to the United Nations. The United States and all civilized nations will continue to take the fight to the terrorists and defeat terrorism on the battlefield. However, to defeat the terrorists, we must fight poverty. And quote, the surest path to greater wealth is greater trade,
By expanding trade, we spread hope and opportunity to the corners of the world, and we strike a blow against the terrorists. Our agenda for freer trade is part of our agenda for a freer world. And in fact, free trade has always been a cornerstone to the Bush agenda. That cornerstone is the one piece of free trade. The other side is ever expanding, enlarging the largest military that one can possibly handle and not even quite handle, the biggest, most powerful, most expensive military in the world, used to advance a very standard corporate globalization or free trade agenda. And that, for me, these two paths are what best define what I call the Bush agenda. Now, just to be clear, this book is about 30 years of policy that hopefully culminate, in what I call the Bush agenda. It is looking at the policies of Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Robert Zoellick, the former U.S. trade representative, Scooter Libby, Richard Pearl, and looking at their 30 years of joint experience, their 30 years of policymaking and writing, their 30 years experience for virtually all of them that includes stints as corporate CEOs, and how this policymaking merges and reaches hopefully its apex in this administration, and which I call the reason why I call it the Bush agenda is because of its reaching its apex here, not necessarily because young George W. Is the brains behind it, although he is in no way a random character in the story, just to be clear. I wrote the book, as I said, as an organizing tool. It does what I hope we are here to do today, which is identify the weak links in the agenda, identify the weak links in the war, so that we can take advantage of those weak links, exploit them, and stop not only the war, but the agenda. And the key link that I focus on is the corporations. And I'm going to explain through this story why they are, they are one of two of the weakest links. The other weak link, which I'll talk about, are the U.S. soldiers, which are increasingly turning against the war, and which are increasingly organizing against the war. And if there aren't soldiers to fight, there won't be a war. That makes them the weak link, not that they are weak in any way themselves personally. The book looks at four corporations in particular, and the reason why I chose these corporations, in addition to their very long histories in Iraq, working with Saddam Hussein, their deep committed interest to expanding their economic relationship with Iraq, the role of their executives in lobbying for war against Iraq, their immense profits from that war, their very long and deep links to the Bush administration. These are also companies on which there are ongoing organizing campaigns right now that we can all and should all plug into in our anti-war organizing. These are ongoing campaigns that existed before the war and hopefully won't exist after it, because we will have solved all the problems with the corporations. The companies are the Bechtel Corporation, based in San Francisco, the country's largest construction and engineering company, the Halliburton Corporation, of which you are hopefully intimately aware, the Chevron, and Lockheed Martin. I'm going to back up real quick for 1 second. I trace the key documents that for me define what this agenda is to understand it and clarify it, and I'm just going to make quick reference to one because I think it's the key document, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with the organization, the Project for the New American Century. Project for the New American Century was begun in, I believe, 1992 or 93. It's in the book. And it is essentially a grouping for the neocons that they used as a think tank and a place to put forward their most bold ideas because they weren't in office at the time, and it was a place for them to define what their ideas really were and to be really honest about it because they weren't in public office, and they could sit around a table and talk about what it was that they really wanted to do. And when I say they and the neoconservatives, I'm referring to 16 members of the Bush administration. So it's not random that we on the left talk about the Project for the New American Century. It is because their work, given that the signatories to many of the documents of the Project for the New American Century, including many of the founding documents, the people who signed them are the likes of Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Khalilzad, Zelig, Pearl, all the key figures of the Bush administration. So this is a wonderful place to go to get an idea of what they're interested in. One of the most important documents is Building America's Defenses, written in 2000. And this document uses the term Pax Americana over and over and over and over and over again to make sure you don't miss it. What we have and what we must maintain is a Pax Americana. Now, Pax Americana refers to the Pax Romana, the belief that there was a 200-year history in Roman times when the Roman Empire was so militarily and economically dominant that it guaranteed world peace because no other nation would want to challenge it, and therefore the world was peaceful. Now, I call this a mythical period and a very worrisome ideal for the members of the current White House and administration to be seeking to maintain for a couple reasons. The first is the Roman Empire ran on 50% slave labor. 50% of the entire population were slaves. So for that 50% of the population, it wasn't a particularly peaceful time. In addition, any region that would not serve up its natural resources or its human resources to the empire was dealt with in a singularly non-peaceful way. In addition, while it was a less imperial period, there were still pretty important imperial attacks if you were, say, Germania, which was invaded and taken over at the time. However, it was a period that was very peaceful for the leaders of the empire. It was a uniquely peaceful time. They had significantly less changeover. The leaders held consistent power. And that is actually what most people are referring to when they talk about the Roman peace. In addition, just to make note, in terms of something that we are, you know, seeking to emulate, it was an empire. There was an emperor. The emperor was the leader. This wasn't the time when there was a republic or any sort of democratic or representative system of government. It was an emperor. And this is clearly something that the Bush administration is seeking to emulate as it pulls more and more and more power into the hands of the executive. This is not something I personally think the United States wants to emulate. I want the United States to emulate. But this is what they're after. And there certainly is the peace. The building up the world's largest military to expand an economic power. I don't think one thing they are trying to do is build an incredibly strong American economy. I don't think that that's something they're working on. If it is, they're not doing a very good job at it. They are very interested in using the military to expand the interests of a select handful of corporations, which also have a very large a connection to the Bush administration itself. So these four companies represent four industries, and actually I will bring them down to two key industries. Weapons, the tools of the military, Lockheed Martin, the largest weapons manufacturer in the United States and the largest weapons exporter in the world. Now, Lockheed Martin is the company I choose, again, not randomly. There are, again, this magical number of 16. 16 current or past Lockheed executives who currently serve in the Bush administration. 16. That is an unprecedented umbilical link between one company and one administration. Unprecedented. Including Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, who was a member of Lockheed's board. But there are many more connections than that. Then you have Bechtel and Halliburton, which in this case I'm putting into a very similar category. They build and provide the infrastructure for many other corporations.
They also are both heavily engaged in the energy sector, obviously Halliburton almost exclusively, but Bechtel builds oil pipelines, builds oil infrastructure as well. But Bechtel is also a privatizer, a water privatizer in particular. And it was actually following Bechtel that I went to Cochabamba, where I met Evo Morales, in learning from the incredible activism that had taken place there to kick Bechtel out of the country after Bechtel had privatized their water systems, which is why the joke about James Carville going down to Bolivia to teach the Bolivians about, you know, politics and organizing, my God, you know, these are the folks who you learn from, not who you try and teach. So then there's Bechtel. Bechtel also has very deep connections to the Republican Party. In addition, Riley Bechtel and Steve Bechtel, if you didn't get it, Bechtel is a family-owned business, has been for a very long time. The Bechtels have key positions within the Bush administration as well. Then we have Halliburton. I don't think I need to say very much about Halliburton here in Texas. And then we have Chevron. Now, Chevron, the one oil company. I'm going to tell you why this is the oil company that I give the greatest focus to as opposed to all the others. However, you have a lot of really great oil companies to focus on here. And there's three key oil companies when we talk about the Iraq war. So remember these oil companies. Exxon, you can repeat them after me. Exxon? Thank you. ExxonMobil. Chevron? It's just Chevron, actually. They thought that when they merged the name Chevron Texaco, it was too hard for people to remember. So that lasted for about 6 months, and then they changed it back to Chevron, because we're all just a little too simple-minded. ConocoPhillips. Okay, great. Those are the three companies that we need to know about when we're talking about the war in Iraq. Chevron is the one I write about, though. The reason why is this is the first time in American history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former oil or energy company officials. In fact, the president and the secretary of state have more experience running oil companies than they do working for the government. It is very well known that Condoleezza Rice had a Chevron oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza. But seriously, they changed the name because it got a little too much bad press for everybody involved. But it is very less well known, and it's not surprising given that she's an African-American woman, that it is appreciated that she earned it. She spent 10 years on the board of directors of Chevron as the head of their policy-making committee. She's intimately connected to this company and this industry. And this company is intimately connected to the administration. All right, these four companies also have a very long history in Iraq. But let me back up real quickly. The connection to the oil industry of this family, the Bush family, of this administration, cannot be diminished. The oil industry contributed 13 times more money, 13 times, to the Bush-Cheney ticket in 2000 than to their challengers. That is an enormous quantity of money because we're also talking about the oil industry. The oil industry has also gotten what they've paid for. Subsidies, tax breaks, access to other regions, new regions to drill. Obviously not having to pay royalties on public land and the like. They've also gotten a war for oil. Now, how many people have ever in the past, oh, I don't know, now 10 years, been made to feel somewhat simplistic by saying that the U.S. wars against Iraq are about oil? Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Okay? It's about oil. It's about oil. Why the hell wouldn't it be about oil? Iraq is like a pimple of oil. It is bursting with oil. It is, many people believe, the country with the largest reserves of oil in the world. The oil is literally right below the surface. The oil is cheap to get to. The oil is rich. The oil has not been exploited as many people would like it to be. And it's waiting to have a, you know, pipeline put in. In addition, I'm going to give you the history of U.S. oil companies and their interest in Iraq. And why it's so obvious, but let's just say this as well. Oil is not just about profits for a few companies, although it is very much about that. Oil is also about a lot of other things, right? He who has it
can deny it to others who want it. He who has it can dictate the terms on which it circulates. He who has it, and I'm saying he intentionally, has tremendous power for that Pax Americana, right? For that world peace. We've got it. You don't have to fight for it. We'll give it to you. Don't worry. You don't have to build militaries so that you can get it, which is what a lot of people think is happening with Japan and China. They're building militaries so that they can get to the oil. We'll have the oil. Don't worry. We'll give it to you. It's okay. That's the idea. So it is about oil. It is about regional power, of course, which has a tremendous to do about Israel. It is also about access to U.S. corporations broadly to the rest of the Middle East. The Reagan administration opened up economic engagement with Saddam Hussein under intense pressure by U.S. business through something called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum. And this little-known guy, you might have heard of him, Henry Kissinger, something called Kissinger Associates, were the two key entities lobbying aggressively for U.S. economic engagement in Iraq. The companies that were members of these, that were members of the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, we don't know the companies that work with Henry Kissinger because he requires confidentiality agreements to be signed by all companies, and they can't even say that they hire Kissinger Associates, so we don't know who he works for. Are Bechtel, KBR, Lockheed Martin, Chevron, lots of other companies as well. Those companies had very fruitful economic engagement with Saddam Hussein. KBR built lots of pipelines. KBR has been working in Iraq since the 50s, but most importantly in the 80s when that economic door was opened up wide, KBR went in. In fact, there were KBR employees on the ground working on oil pipelines when the first invasion of Iraq, U.S. invasion, took place. Bechtel wanted to build an oil pipeline for Saddam Hussein to get oil out of Iraq. But Saddam Hussein nixed it because he didn't believe that the Americans would be able to secure the pipeline as it went through Israel. But Bechtel did succeed in getting a contract to manage a petrochemical complex for Saddam Hussein that that generated the precursor to mustard gas that was put to very good use by Saddam Hussein against the Iranians and the Kurds. Lockheed Martin sold helicopters to Saddam Hussein, and Chevron marketed Iraqi oil.
You're listening to Antonia Yuhas on Oilgarchy. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
Where Reagan opened the relationship, George Bush I busted the door open. The initial engagement with Saddam Hussein was as a hedge against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. But when Bush I came through, 1988 marked the end of the Iran-Iraq war, and it was an opportunity to change the relationship with Saddam Hussein. And I have a quote in here from a memo that his transition team gave to President Bush that says basically this: you can treat Saddam as a hated dictator who we know is going to continue to kill those who oppose him, to torture those who share different views, to do all these horrible things that we know he's done, or you can treat him as a close ally because he sits on an enormous pot of oil and he opens a gateway to the rest of the Middle East where there is more oil. And he can be a very good trading partner for U.S. businesses. And the Bush administration chose the latter position. What one thing that Saddam Hussein would not do was allow U.S. oil companies into Iraq. He would allow those companies to market oil, which means basically you sort of take it, you know, from the port and sell and ship it out and refine it and sell it. But you don't get the ownership of the oil in the ground, and you get a very small portion of the profits, basically, that way. And you also don't get to book the oil on your accounts to say, we have this much oil, Shell has this much oil, Chevron has this much oil. In addition, Saddam Hussein was proving to be less than a good ally in the region. One thing that happened with the first invasion of Iraq was, I believe, that the Bush 1 was not nearly as imperial as the second Bush administration. But in addition, times had not yet changed as they were going to change 10 years later. Times in terms of the power of the oil companies and times in terms of the vision of the men at the top. I have a lot of quotes from Cheney and others at the time who said, we just didn't want to own Iraq. And I don't believe that they did at the time. I think they just wanted to unseat Saddam alone by himself. And when they felt like that wasn't going to happen unless they owned Iraq, they stepped back. In the intervening 10 years, a critical time, a bunch of things happened. One of the most important, and it mostly happened at the end of those 10 years, was first the incredible merging of the U.S., of the United States' largest oil companies. So what we had this back and forth about, what are the names of these companies, right? Exxon merges with Mobil. Chevron merges with Texaco, merges with Occidental. Conoco merges with Phillips. Hundreds of oil companies dwindled down to a mere handful. These companies, today, the five largest oil companies in the world, produce more oil every day than Saudi Arabia. These companies are incredibly integrated, vertically integrated, so that the same company is in charge of exploration, production, refining, marketing, sales. That is immense control over a very vital resource, right? That is also the key to some pretty darn big profits. Okay, we cannot ever not say this. That's a double negative enough. ExxonMobil, for 3 years, has earned the largest profits ever in world history for any company ever. And then it topped it the next year. And then it topped it the next year. And this year, its first quarter, or its profits up till this quarter, are 35 times larger than last year. That's not just bad because some of us don't like companies having lots of money. That's bad because that gives ExxonMobil incredible control over our elected officials so that they will do things like fight wars, invade countries, occupy countries, kill thousands if not hundreds of thousands of people, make our soldiers do it, make them die. Because these companies make Exxon makes $36 billion extra cash on hand. Don't ever underestimate that money or the power that it brings. And just really quickly, because there's a news report put out by the organization that I'm with, the Institute for Policy Studies, on CEO pay. It comes out every year. But this year they focused on CEO pay for arms manufacturers and for oil companies. Okay, so first in the overall CEO pay to worker pay. 25 years ago, the ratio between CEO pay and worker pay was 32 to 1. Today, it's 411 to 1. The oil companies saw much higher increases in their CEO compensation. But in particular, in the last 3 years, oil company CEO compensation has increased on average 50%, in some cases 200%. But the worker compensation for oil company workers has increased less than 4%. So when they say that this money is, you know, being used for all of us and is important and necessary, it's certainly not, you know, helping out the folks in the company. And just to put that into perspective, during World War II, there was these folks called the Dollar a Year Men. These were the CEOs of the companies that were working in the war field, were building the weapons, the oil companies and the like. These CEOs took compensation of just $1 a year because we were all involved in the war effort. That is something that we might want to, you know, bring up to these CEOs. Okay. 10 days into the first term of the second Bush administration, Cheney organized something called the Cheney Energy Task Force. And the Cheney Energy Task Force was composed of Chevron, all the oil companies, Halliburton, Bechtel.
And they put out a document that we only know about because the Supreme Court forced it out, which was called a document that was called Foreign Suitors to Iraqi Oil. And it listed companies that Saddam Hussein in the late 90s had signed oil contracts with. Saddam Hussein needed money and he was starting to sign oil contracts. And he was signing them with companies from China and Russia and France and all sorts of companies, but not a single one was from the United States. The writing was on the wall that the sanctions were going to be eliminated. Public opinion, many people here worked very aggressively to expose the devastating effects of sanctions on the Iraqi public. If the sanctions were lifted, all of those other oil companies were going to get all of that oil, and U.S. oil companies would be shut out. A great lobbying effort went forward. Some groups were called the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq was one. George Shultz, who was on the board of directors of Bechtel, led that effort, calling for the invasion of Iraq. Before the invasion took place, there was a contract signed with a company called Bearing Point, Inc. And Bearing Point was given the contract to rewrite Iraq's economic infrastructure. So it is an absolute fallacy when people claim that there was no post-war planning. There was very clear post-war planning. It was economic. Bearing Point's plan for the reconstruction of Iraq was then put in place to the T by Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, for 14 months. Paul Bremer implemented a standard corporate globalization agenda. If you take policies of the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the North American Trade Agreement, wrap them up into a little ball and throw them on Iraq, that's what happened. And then they just threw in some other stuff for good measure because they could, like the flat tax. Some of the right wing has always wanted. They did it in Iraq because they couldn't do it here. Lowering the tax rate for corporations by 25%, an immense reduction in taxes for a country that was desperately in need of money. Some of the other provisions. Allowing for the full privatization of all of Iraq's state-owned enterprises. Something called national treatment, which made it impossible for Iraqis to give preference to Iraqi companies or Iraqi workers in the reconstruction. Instead, companies like Bechtel, Halliburton, got enormous reconstruction contracts. But also Parsons, Shaw, Perini. There are 11 U.S. corporations that all received over $1.5 billion in reconstruction contracts. Most of them are in the $3 billion, $5 billion, $8 billion range. Then there was provisions for the 100% ownership of Iraqi businesses by foreign companies, 100% repatriation of profits. Every penny earned in Iraq could be sent home. Not a cent needed to be reinvested in the Iraqi economy. I go through all of these orders, the key orders, extensively in what I think is the most important chapter of my book, The Economic Invasion of Iraq. So I won't go through all of them here. But the two other most important ones were, one, full immunity from Iraqi laws for U.S. companies. In addition, the provisions of the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which are so controversial everywhere else in the world, implemented overnight by Paul Bremer in Iraq because, hey, we invaded. All of these economic policies locked in vital access for U.S. companies. The companies have also failed miserably at the most important job that they were assigned, reconstruction. And I go again through this in detail, and I won't go through it here now as to why they failed. But there's two most basic answers. The first is, okay, first of all, the very first Bremer order was something called the debathification order. Through this order, Bremer fired 160,000 of all of the leading bureaucrats in the Iraqi government, the heads of the water ministry, the electricity ministry, the hospitals, the schools. They were fired because of their membership in the Ba'ath Party. However, to work in the civil service, you had to join the Ba'ath Party. So everybody was a member of the Ba'ath Party. Firing them first eliminated the brain power of all of the people who ran all of the key institutions, but it also eliminated those who would challenge
the new economic regime put in place by Paul Bremer. So they were gone, and their expertise was gone. U.S. companies were brought in. They didn't know the systems they were fixing. They didn't hire Iraqis because they didn't trust them. And they found out that the systems were made way more difficult to repair than they had realized. In addition, the longer it took them to get working and the longer it took them to get things fixed, the angrier the Iraqis got, right? At first, the Iraqis were like, okay, great, American companies, maybe that's okay. They're good, you know, they're really good at what they do. They have lots of money. They're going to fix everything up really well. It'll be fast. We'll give them a chance. It was a similar attitude to the U.S. military, right? We'll give you a chance. When the companies and the Iraqis knew they were receiving billions and billions of dollars to be there, and they were utterly failing, and Iraqis were unemployed, and Iraqis were not having their services met, the U.S. companies became the targets of the insurgency. Now, experience has shown in Iraq that when Iraqi companies do get these contracts, and they're increasingly starting to get them, their work is done more quickly, more cheaply, and it is not the target of insurgent attacks. And clearly, I think, a key demand of the United States peace movement needs to be that the U.S. companies need to get out, they need to return their misspent funds, and those funds need to be immediately turned over to Iraqi companies. Because even today, in Baghdad, before the war, there were, on average, 24 hours a day of electricity. Electricity controls water and sewage. Today in Iraq, 3.5 years after the war, after we've paid Bechtel $2.8 billion, we've paid Parsons and Shaw and a number of other U.S. corporations billions of dollars, electricity in Iraq is provided on average of 8 hours a day. There is not water or sewage when there is not electricity. This is a failure, right? This is a failure that makes Baghdad very unsafe for U.S. soldiers because there's a lot of anger there, and it's obvious why there would be. It also explains part of the explanation for today's poll numbers, and I hope everyone saw this. A State Department, U.S. State Department poll of Iraqis found that the strong majority of Iraqis want U.S. troops out immediately. That three-fourths of Baghdadis believe that they will be much safer if the U.S. troops go home. That they want the military out. And U.S. soldiers, a recent poll of U.S. soldiers found that 72% of them in Iraq right now think that they need to be out of there in at least, in minimum, at maximum, a year. That they think they should go home. That the Iraqis think that they should go home. But not just them. The companies have to come home too. So the Bremer orders laid the groundwork for the big prize, the oil. The oil companies are smarter than the Bush administration. The Bremer orders are illegal under international law. You can't invade a country and then change its laws. It goes against the Geneva Conventions. Not that the administration cares a heck of a lot for the Geneva Conventions, but the oil companies are a little bit smarter and they do. They chose a slower path, a more careful path. In the U.S. State Department, before the war, there was a committee that met to draft a new oil law for Iraq. One member of that working group was later appointed by Paul Bremer as one of the first oil ministers of Iraq. And what he did in that position was cancel all of those pre-existing oil contracts that Saddam Hussein had signed. Okay, those are gone. They then devised a new model for Iraq's oil infrastructure, which would eliminate the nationalized oil system and implement a law that would open Iraq to private foreign corporate investment on terms that are highly favorable to the foreign oil companies on unprecedented terms for any oil-rich nation in the world. That law is set to be implemented in about a month. There is very little knowledge of that law among the Iraqi public. It has been aggressively pushed and lobbied for by U.S. oil companies. The oil companies that are sort of hovering around, that are the ones that are set to get the first oil contracts, they hope. Chevron, Exxon, Conoco, and then Shell and BP. What we have been asked by Iraqi partners is a demand that the U.S. and its oil companies and the administration eliminate that pressure eliminate the occupation so that the Iraqis can have a debate and a discussion about what to do with their oil, right? Fairly important. In addition, most Iraqis, when they're asked, believe that the United States invaded Iraq to get its oil. So if at the end of the day, what happens is that U.S. oil companies get into Iraq, which is what they wanted before and were denied, regardless of what you think about that, it wouldn't look very good. And I don't think people would be very happy about it. I know I wouldn't be very happy about it. The 1 month after the invasion of Iraq, President Bush announced plans for the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area to take this economic agenda to the rest of the Middle East. The Middle East is an area rich in oil, right? Areas like Africa, Central and South America, very poor regions that had to sacrifice for loans from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, had to adhere to trade agreements, had to implement those sacrifices. The Middle East, largely not, hasn't done it. However, country after country is signing on to the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area because they are locked in. They're being told, you know, you're either with us or against us. There is an enormous sense of fear across the Middle East about what the United States is willing to do to see its interests met. And countries are signing on very quickly, again, without any public debate, without mostly any knowledge of their public that the agreements are even being negotiated. And the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area is a completely unique negotiating platform. It is a series of bilateral deals. The U.S. negotiates with an individual country at a time instead of big groups like the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which was brought down because of the coming together of developing countries, or the World Trade Organization, which was brought down by the coming together of developing countries. The U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area is advancing quickly because Oman has signed on, Jordan has signed on, Morocco has signed on, because they're one country against the United States. So we, as the peace movement, have to be aware of the larger agenda at hand so that we can also bring in the discussion of the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area, because where I started, I think the corporations are a weak link. I think it's for several reasons. One, the success that we have had in organizing against the corporations. The amazing organizing that happened in Texas against Halliburton, which helped bring awareness about Halliburton, which helped spur members of Congress to take action in monitoring Halliburton closely, to demand an account for Halliburton's misspent funds, has ended up in Halliburton losing its largest contract that it has, about $11 billion log cap contract. They lost it this year. They lost it not because they wanted to, not because Cheney wanted Halliburton to lose out on $11 billion. They lost it because of the public pressure and the public demand that this company be held to account for its actions. Yes, yay. The Bechtel Corporation was a target of protest constantly in San Francisco. They hate public attention. They did not seek new contracts in Iraq way back, about 2 years into the war. They stopped seeking contracts in Iraq because they didn't want any more of the public pressure. And talk about cutting and running. Bechtel is a company that thought that it would be able to privatize in Iraq. Things are not nearly so stable there, and there's too much opposition to privatization in Iraq. There's too much opposition here. And they, unfortunately, I'm glad they're not privatizing, but they are definitely planning on cutting and running. They're going to take their money and just leave, and leave the work in shambles. Again, I want them to leave, but I want them to turn back over their money. But again, Bechtel is a success, because if Bechtel doesn't even try to go in, then Iraqi companies have significantly more potential to get those contracts and to do that work. In addition, the more attention that we can give to the corporate link and put pressure on them and put awareness and focus on them, the less interested they will be in being seen as a public face to the Bush agenda, the less profitable it will be for them, and the less interest they will have in saying to the Bush administration, expand this agenda across the Middle East. Yes, everybody wants to see us across the Middle East. not on these terms, and we'll let them know that. And they are a weak link in support, in the support chain. In addition, the corporations and the bad things that they do make sense to the American public. And again, I think what we need right now, this sense that there isn't a movement when the vast majority of the public opposes the war and opposes Bush, is I think a lot of it has to do with the tremendous feeling of disempowerment among the average person. That 15 million of us marched on a Saturday, but the war didn't end on a Sunday. Okay, that's true. Our need for immediate gratification needs to be overcome. And our need to see ourselves on the front page of the paper or on the TV needs to be overcome. If a peace march happens and nobody covers it, it still happened. And that, I think, is a sense that people don't have. But also just this feeling of empowerment, that our actions do create change, and it's slow, though, right? Wars don't necessarily end really easily and really quickly. They're big deals, big powers that be. And we need to embrace that awareness. Then, as I said in the beginning, I think the other powerful link, maybe is the way to say this better, are U.S. soldiers, which are coming back in unprecedented numbers and opposing the war. A most amazing group, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, is a group that everyone should know about. Veterans for Peace, another amazing group doing incredible work right now. There's a counter-recruitment tour taking place across the country with Iraq Vets Against the War and other groups raising awareness, doing counter-recruitment work, which is so important. There are incredible events and organizing happening all over the country. What I hope to leave you with is that we in America have tremendous power and influence. Everywhere I go, every single time I do a radio interview in Pakistan, in South Africa, in Iran, I'm brought on as an economic policy expert, but all they really want to know is, what the hell is wrong with you people? Why won't you change this? It is your damn responsibility. There's a movement to try and get people all around the country to get to vote for the U.S. president in 2008 because it affects everybody else so much that they're all going to vote. And they're going to have a democracy movement for the United States so that we can have some democracy here. Right? We need to have one here. The idea is to spur it here. But that there is incredible organizing happening, incredible organizers in this room. And that we have to take this spirit and harness it and reach out to all the other people that aren't here and say, we are a movement. There are things going on. You know, pat ourselves on the back for what we've done and kick ourselves in the ass to get going again. Thanks very much.
That was Antonia Yuhas on Oilgarchy. She spoke at the University of Texas at Austin on September 28th. 2006. Antonia Yuhas is an expert on international trade and economic policy. She's a visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. An award-winning writer, she's the author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR, celebrating 20 years, is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, Gore Vidal, Kevin Phillips, Arundhati Roy, Tariq Ali, and Howard Zinn. To access our vast catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, tape, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Antonia Yuhas on Oilgarchy, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977, or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Pat Youngblood of Third Coast Activist Resource Center for recording assistance. Allie Lightfoot edited the program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. We go out with, because of FCC rules, an edited version of Billy Bragg's The Price of Oil. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan. But the oil men in the White House, they just don't give a damn. 'Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Don't give me no about blood, sweat, tears and toil. It's all about the price of oil.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.